Okay, so before we get into today's preview, this is going to be part one of this three-part series. Over the next 7 days, there'll be three new podcasts on Jeff Bezos. So this is, I've read, so far for the podcast, I've read something like 186 biographies of entrepreneurs. And I would say if I had to pick one, if you ask me the question, like, out of all the biographies you've read, what is the most insightful one you've read so far? I would probably choose this book, The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos and the Age of Amazon. So for this episode, I reread the book. I read it a few years ago, and great books deserve to be reread. The book stays the same, but you've changed. You've hopefully learned a lot more since then. And so I picked up on a lot of insights the second time around that I missed the first time. And the reason I wanted to reread this is because the author, Brad Stone, wrote a sequel to that book. It's actually coming out this week. It's called Amazon Unbound, Jeff Bezos and the Invention of a Global Empire. And the podcast on that book will be out next week. So today's podcast is The Everything Store. We're rereading that. Then on Wednesday, I'm dropping a bonus episode on this book called Working Backwards. It's all about Amazon's idiosyncratic work processes, the ideas, the unique ideas they apply and how they actually do their work. And it was one of the co-authors was actually Jeff Shadow for 2 years. So he went everywhere with Jeff for 2 years. And so that book is full of insights that you can find nowhere else. And then, of course, part three is going to be Amazon Unbound. But if you're hearing this, that means you're currently not on our subscriber feed and you're only going to hear half of this episode. You can listen to this full episode and 185 other full-length episodes by tapping the link that's in your show notes on your podcast player. If you're new to Founders, listen to a few of the previews on the public feed and then upgrade to get to the full episodes. The premise behind Founders is simple but powerful. Every week, I read a biography of an entrepreneur and I share the key insights. And I do this because the smartest people in the history of the world have distilled their life's work into a few hundred pages. Founders helps you learn these ideas faster. Subscribers to Founders are called Misfits. That name was actually inspired by the Apple ad, "Here's to the Crazy Ones." And that's important because what we're doing here is not normal. Most people do not learn from history, but all of the greatest founders do. By learning from some of the greatest minds in history, you're doing exactly what Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, Steve Jobs, Sam Walton, Warren Buffett, the list just goes on and on and on. They all learned from biographies of those that came before them and applied those ideas to their life and work. And you can do the same by upgrading now by tapping the link that's in your show notes on your podcast player or by going to founderspodcast.com. In January 2013, 8 months before her death, I received a lengthy email from Joy Covey. She had been generous with her memories and insights as I crafted the first few chapters of this book and was wondering how my writing was progressing. She was reading the Steve Jobs biography by Walter Isaacson and was thinking about how Bezos' leadership style compared to the late Apple co-founder's famously direct demeanor. When I rediscovered Covey's email after her death, I was struck by its thoughtfulness and eloquence. Here it is, lightly edited for clarity. "Hello, Brad. I have been wondering how your writing is coming along. Also, I thought of your project and Jeff while beginning the Jobs biography recently. I found myself thinking about what it takes to accomplish things as big as they both did, when a lot of what you are doing is unconventional. It may very well be that the absolute intensity of drive and focus is essential and incompatible with all the nice management thought about consensus and gentle demeanor. I think about how effective and quick Jeff was, and how important it was that he didn't slow down too much or modify his ideas to make others feel comfortable. I think about the early days and the level of clarity, vision, potential, and values that Jeff brought. And then I look at Amazon today and reflect on some of those conversations I had with him in the intervening years. It's easy to draw a straight line from the vision he had back then to the Amazon of today. I don't know any other company that has created such a juggernaut that is so consistent with the original ideas of the founder. It's almost like he fired an arrow and then followed that arc. Can we really think of any other company approaching Amazon's size or age that continues to move forward with the boldness, risk-taking, innovation, and the long-term perspective that Amazon shows? Jeff's clarity, intensity of focus, and ability to prioritize is unusual and behind his ability to keep leaping forward versus protecting existing ground. Seeing the future, he put in place the critical DNA that would help the whole company embody his vision. His focus was on very bright, high growth potential, and fluid-minded people with the right values as builders. He looked for people that absolutely prioritized customer trust and delight, who at all times were long-term focused and driven to be bold and innovative. All of this was lived and modeled every day by Jeff and the senior team. Personal wealth was never discussed or really thought about. I see companies these days where thoughts of exits are foremost in the minds of top management and board, and it is so clear that this value will infect the decision-making down to the smallest choice by the most junior employee. Do we create something that is good, or just something that seems good and might get us acquired or funded? At Amazon, it was always abundantly clear what the goals and values were. And as I reflect on discussions and decisions throughout my time there, it's easy to imagine how different so many small choices might have been otherwise. We talked a lot about whether Jeff was difficult to work with. Yet Jeff attracted people like me, who really needed to work on things they can internalize and adopt as a mission, who had to leave the path they thought they were on, and who poured their hearts and souls and best efforts into building Amazon. We believed in what we were building and felt that our very best was needed to have the hope of accomplishing the enormous potential ahead of us. Jeff's style always read as completely pure, all focused on the best outcomes for Amazon and our customers. As I read the Jobs book, I really had to wonder if that intensity isn't an essential element when so much of what you want to do requires boldness, immediacy, ruthless prioritization, and risk. It seems counterintuitive to everyone who has pursued traditional corporate goals in the past. I even had an insight and question about myself, that maybe I haven't begun to really find my own limits, since I have not, aside from those times of highest stakes and intensity at Amazon, really run free, following my own insights and directions without being too accommodating of others. I think Jeff is one of the most capable and effective founders ever. And I think the Amazon juggernaut is still in its early stages. Cheers. Joy. That is an excerpt from the book that I just reread, which is The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos and the Age of Amazon, and was written by Brad Stone. So I read this book about 2.5 years ago. Originally, it's Founders Number 17. And the reason I'm rereading it, well, there's two reasons. One, great books should be reread because the book stays the same, but you change. And I've read, 160-something biographies of entrepreneurs since then. And two, because Brad Stone, the author, is writing a sequel. He's releasing a sequel to this book. It's called Amazon Unbound. It is going to be released next week, I think. So I was like, okay, once I learned that this book was coming out, I was like, I'm going to reread the week before I cover the new Brad Stone book. I need to reread The Everything Store. It's really hard to categorize books. A lot of people email me and ask me, like, you know, give me your top 10, give me your top 20. What's the most inspiring book? What's the most interesting book? And so on and so forth. And then some people ask me, like, what is the most insightful book or insightful biography, rather? If I had to choose one, if I was absolutely forced, and obviously there's tons of useful information that we're learning in these books, but if I had to answer what is the single most insightful biography I've ever read, it would be this book. I think this book is absolutely necessary for anybody that wants to improve, whether you're a founder, investor, manager, college student, whatever the case is. You should read the book. It's full of useful insights that you can apply to your work. Before I jump into the rest of the book, I want to go back to that email from Joy, one of the early Amazon employees, to the author, where she's talking about what reading the biography of Steve Jobs, like what impact that's having on her life. And I double underlined what she said, where she's talking about the realizations, which I think it's normal. You're reading and learning about the life of somebody else, but really you're reading and learning, you're taking those lessons and thinking about how it applies to yourself. And she said, I even had an insight and question about myself. And that's a simple sentence that has a profound meaning. And that's why I constantly encourage you to read as many of these biographies as you can, because you will have questions and insights about yourself. by reading and learning the life stories of others. All right, so let's go to the beginning of the book, and I want to spend some time talking about the younger version of Jeff Bezos. I really do feel it gives us the essence of who this person is. It says, in the early 1970s, an industrious advertising executive named Julie Ray became fascinated with an unconventional public school program for gifted children in Houston, Texas. Her son was among the first students enrolled in what would later be called the Vanguard program, which stoked creativity and independence in its students and nurtured expansive, outside-the-box thinking. She grew so enamored with the curriculum that she set out to research similar schools around the state with an eye toward writing a book about Texas's gifted education movement. So at this point, her son's no longer in the program, so she goes back and she's touring the program to do research for the book, okay? So it says the school's principal chose a student to accompany her on her visit, an articulate, sandy-haired sixth grader whose parents asked only that his real name not be used in print. So Ray called him Tim. Tim, Julie Ray wrote in her book, Turning on Bright Minds, A Parent Looks at Gifted Education in Texas, was a student of general intellectual excellence, friendly but serious. He was not particularly gifted in leadership, according to his teachers, but he moved confidently among his peers and articulately extolled the virtues of the novel he was reading at the time, which is The Hobbit by Tolkien. Tim was already competitive. Remember, he's 12 years old at this time, okay? Was already competitive. He told Ray he was reading a variety of books to qualify for a specials reader certificate. Tim also showed Ray a science project he was working on called an Infinity Cube, which is a battery-powered contraption that created an optical illusion of an endless tunnel. Teachers said that three of Tim's projects were being entered into the local science competition that drew most of its submissions from students in junior and senior high schools. Tim's average day was packed. He woke up early and caught a 7 o'clock bus a block from home. He arrived at school after a 20-mile ride and went through a blaze of classes devoted to math, reading, physical education, science, Spanish, and art. There was time reserved for individual projects and small group discussions. In one lesson, seven students, including Tim, sat in a tight circle in the principal's office for an exercise called productive thinking. They were given brief stories to read quietly to themselves and then discuss. Now, this is going to be interesting. So not only am I going to read, I reread this book, I'm going to read the sequel to the book when it comes out, but in the interim, I had just finished reading Working Backwards. It's a new book that was just released by two of senior Amazon leaders. One of the co-authors was actually Jeff's shadow, which means he went everywhere with Jeff for 2 years. And so that book is all about the way the actual tactics and strategies that Amazon uses to run its business, okay? But this idea where Jeff is 12 years old and he's sitting in the principal's office and they give him a brief and everybody has to read first before the discussion is amusing because that's an actual strategy used in Amazon before a meeting. They say when new people are hired by Amazon, and I'll talk more about this in the bonus episode that'll come out on Working Backwards, but when new people are hired, they're like, what's up with this eerie silence at the very beginning of the meetings? Because everybody's sitting there and reading the same information before they begin the discussion. So I thought that was interesting. Tim told Julie Ray that he loved these exercises. You have to be able to think what you're doing for yourself, he said. Ray found it impossible to interest a publisher in her book. Editors at the big houses said the subject matter was too narrow. So, and then we see she has a little bit of an entrepreneurial founder mentality here. I love this. So in 1977, she took the money she earned from writing advertising copy, printed 1,000 paperbacks, and distributed them herself. More than 30 years later, I found a copy in the Houston Public Library. I also tracked down Julie Ray, who now lives in Central Texas. She said she had watched Tim's rise to fame and fortune over the past 2 decades with admiration and amazement, but without surprise. When I met him as a young boy, his ability was obvious, and it was being nurtured and encouraged by the new program. She recalls what one teacher said to her all those years ago when Ray asked her to estimate the grade level the boy was performing at. I really can't say, the teacher replied, except that there is probably no limit what he can do. In late 2011, I went to visit Tim, also known as Jeff Bezos, in the Seattle headquarters of his company. I was there to solicit his cooperation with this book, an attempt to chronicle the extraordinary rise of an innovative, disruptive, and often polarizing technology powerhouse. The company was among the first to see the boundless promise of the internet, and that ended up forever changing the way we shop and read. Okay, so Stone winds up meeting with Bezos. I'm going to skip over that part. I want to get into other people's description of Bezos. And so this is Eric Schmidt. At the time, he was the chairman of Google, and I found this was very interesting. He says, "To me, Amazon is the story of a brilliant founder who personally drove the vision. There are almost no better examples. Perhaps Apple, but people forgot that most people believed Amazon was doomed because it would not scale at a cost structure that would work. It kept piling up losses. It lost hundreds of millions of dollars. But Jeff was very, very smart. He's a classic technical founder of a business who understands every detail and cares about it more than anyone." So this book is a snapshot in time. It was first published in 2014. The reason I think it's so important to read this book, and in general, books about early company history, is because you see all the pain that the founder, that the early people in the company had to go through to make the company successful. It's very easy to look at Amazon today and be like, wow, they're huge. They must have always been, you know, they're very smart. They have access to resources. This must have been easy, and it is not. I own both the paperback version and the Kindle version of this. I think the word pain appears something like it was like 20 times. It's like every 20 pages on average. It's talks about being the painful stuff they had to endure, the pain, the problems they had to overcome. And I think reading about this, reading about the pain, reading about these experiences, these problems, it serves as a great reminder for the rest of us. So it says, Bezos has proved quite indifferent to the opinion of others. He's an avid problem solver, a man who has a chess master's view of the competitive landscape, and he applies the focus of an obsessive compulsive to pleasing customers. He is also extremely difficult to work for. So there is going to be multiple times I was reading this book, and I'm reading the thoughts and the ideas of Jeff, and I'm just like, this guy is brilliant. He's really smart. But a big part of the book is, I don't know if I wouldn't work for him. Let's just put it that way. I want to learn from him, but I don't want to be on the side of transaction that where, you know, he can be extremely rude and demanding and borderline violent. And so I don't want to. The purpose of this podcast is not to idolize him. He's a human being, which means he's flawed just like you and I. Yes, he's extremely intelligent, extremely driven, extremely successful. We're going to learn a lot of the great ideas that he had discovered, you know, through multiple decades of working at his career. But he's also can be extremely cruel. And if you've read the book or if you read the book, you'll see multiple examples of that. So it says, Bezos is a micromanager with a limitless spring of new ideas, and he reacts harshly to efforts that don't meet his rigorous standards. So I interrupted that page a lot. Let me just review. So Jeff is indifferent to the opinions of others. He's obsessive compulsive to pleasing customers. He's difficult to work with. He's a micromanager. He has limitless new ideas, and he demands that you meet his rigorous standards. Moving ahead, there's an idea that he learned from the founder of Sony, Akio Morita, that you should have your company. You need a mission that's larger than your company. It's yourself. He often says that Amazon's corporate mission is to raise the bar across industries and around the world for what it means to be customer focused. Bezos and his employees are indeed absorbed with catering to customers, but they can also be ruthlessly competitive with rivals and even partners. More on his personality and the way he communicates. Bezos is an excruciatingly prudent communicator for his own company. He is sphinx-like with details of his plans, and he keeps his thoughts and intentions private. And then there's this one line here that I think is the main reason why you want to read this book. Amazon's internal customs are deeply idiosyncratic. More on his personality. He is engaged and full of twitchy, passionate energy. If you catch him in the hallway, he will not hesitate to inform you that he never takes the office elevator. He always takes the stairs. He is highly circumspect about deviating from well-established, very abstract talking points. So they use the shorthand for Jeff's maxims, or are called Jeffisms. But really, this is something I want to bring to your attention, that repetition is persuasive. This comes up in almost every biography that I read. You have a set of ideas. You have to repeat them over and over again. It helps the people that you're teaching remember and then adapt that to actually change their behavior. I always think of Sol Price as the most influential retailer to ever live. Talking about Jeff Bezos learned ideas from him. Sam Walton learned ideas from him. Jim Sinegal, the founder of Costco, learned ideas from him. Bernie Marcus, the founder of Home Depot. I did a podcast on him a long time ago. I don't know what number it is, but you'll find it. Sol Price. I think it's Revolutionary Retailer, Retail Revolutionary. Anyways, there's a line in that book that I never forgot. And he's like, you train an animal. You teach a person. And so when you're studying the history of entrepreneurship, you realize a lot of founders, yes, they're defined as maybe an entrepreneur or retailer, whatever field they're in, but a lot of them describe themselves as teachers. And then I just want to read this paragraph to you because it's just really, really great writing. The goal of this book is to tell the story behind one of the greatest entrepreneurial successes since Sam Walton flew his two-seat turboprop across the American South to scope out prospective Walmart store sites. It's the tale of how one gifted child grew into an extraordinary, driven, and versatile CEO, and how he, his family, and his colleagues bet heavily on a revolutionary network called the Internet, and on the grandiose vision of a single store that sells everything. Okay, so let's go to Jeff, what Jeff Bezos was like in his 20s, and where the idea of Amazon came from. So this is another guy that he learned a lot from, another founder. His name is David Shaw. I've looked for biographies on him. I can't find any. If you happen to find any, please send them my way. He sounds like a very interesting person, and we're going to learn a little bit about him here. The broader financial community knew very little about D.E. Shaw, so that's his hedge fund, and its polymath founder wanted to keep it that way. You're going to see his obsession with secrecy. Jeff takes this trait and runs with it as well. To this day, he's still like this. The firm preferred operating far below the radar and keeping its proprietary trading algorithms out of competitors' hands. Shaw felt strongly that if Desco was going to be the firm that pioneered new approaches to investing, the only way to maintain its lead was to keep its insights secret and avoid teaching competitors how to think about these new computer-guided frontiers. Shaw had earned a PhD in computer science from Stanford in 1980, moves to New York, teaches in Columbia Science Computer Science Department. High-tech companies tried to lure him away into the private sector. Inventor Danny Hillis, who founded the supercomputer manufacturer called Thinking Machines Corporation, he's also one of Jeff Bezos' closest friends, almost convinced Shaw to come work with him. Shaw accepted the job and then changed his mind, telling Hillis he wanted to do something more lucrative and could always return to the supercomputer field after he got wealthy. Hillis argued that even if Shaw did get rich, which seemed unlikely, he'd never return to computer science. Shaw did return to computer science after he became a billionaire and passed on the day-to-day management of D.E. Shaw to others. By design, D.E. Shaw would be a different kind of Wall Street firm. Shaw recruited not financiers, but scientists and mathematicians. Big brains with unusual backgrounds, lofty academic credentials, and more than a touch of social cluelessness. David wanted to see the power of technology and computers applied to finance in a scientific way, and that he looked up to Goldman Sachs and wanted to build an iconic Wall Street firm. So Bezos winds up being hired there. This is 1991. Bezos was in his mid-20s at the time. He had the pasty, rumpled appearance of a committed workaholic. He had spent 5 years on Wall Street and impressed seemingly everyone he encountered with his keen intellect and boundless determination. Bezos had graduated from Princeton. And this is a description of Bezos from one of his colleagues. And you'll see this is repeated over and over again throughout the book and at different points of Bezos' life. And it says he was not concerned what other people were thinking. Another description of Bezos from one of his colleagues. Bezos had closely studied several wealthy businessmen, and he particularly admired a man named Frank Meeks. In other words, he described the founders, a Virginia entrepreneur who made a fortune owning Domino's pizza franchises. Bezos also revered pioneering computer scientist Alan Kay and often quoted his observation. This is really, really brilliant, and I need to remember this. Sometimes I forget about this. So Alan Kay says that a point of view is worth 80 IQ points. So what does that mean? It's a reminder that looking at things in new ways can enhance one's understanding. He went to school on everybody. I don't think there was anybody Jeff knew that he didn't walk away from with whatever lessons he could. Bezos would later say he found a workplace soulmate in David Shaw. At Desco, Bezos displayed many of the idiosyncratic qualities his employees would later observe at Amazon. He was disciplined and precise. He constantly recorded his ideas in a notebook that he carried with him as if they might float out of his mind if he didn't jot them down. So that's another thing multiple people say throughout his life, that he has too many ideas. There's no way. You could have unlimited resources and you still cannot apply and actually work on all the ideas that come tumbling out of Jeff's mind. And this is another really good idea. I always say this is something I learned from Charlie Munger's Poor Charlie's Almanac book, that you should look at ideas like tools. You are not your ideas. So when a better idea comes along, or maybe one that's more useful to the situation you're in, you pull out another tool, just like you would if you were building something physically. He quickly abandoned old notions and embraced new ones when better options presented themselves. More on his personality. Bezos thought analytically about everything. He was the most introspective guy I had ever met. He was very methodical about everything in his life. Bezos seemed to love the idea of the nonstop workday. He kept a rolled up sleeping bag in his office in case he needed to bunk down for the night. Now, this is also another very interesting idea from David Shaw that Bezos will apply later at Amazon. So it's the idea of thinking about what your company actually is as opposed to what people think it is. And let me read this to you and I'll see how Bezos applies it and how we can apply it to whatever we're doing. While the rest of Wall Street saw D.E. Shaw as a highly secretive hedge fund, the firm viewed itself somewhat differently. In David Shaw's estimation, so in his description of his own company, remember this for later too, the company wasn't really a hedge fund, but a versatile technology laboratory full of innovators and talented engineers who could apply computer science to a variety of different problems. So everybody else on the outside says it's a hedge fund. He's saying we're a technology laboratory full of innovators and talented engineers who apply computer science to different problems. Investing was only the first domain where it would apply its skills. So later on, everybody describes, you know, Amazon's just a bookseller. And Bezos is like, that's where we are now. Eventually, we'll be the everything store. And then once they start adding more products, he talks about, and I'll go into more detail about this later. He's like, no, we're the unstore. Because technology gives us an advantage over the ancient, like, physical retailers. And later on, he talks about it's a technology company. He's constantly refining. And two things are interesting here. One, the constant refinement of how he sees his own company, which should change over time, right? And two, how it's always different than how other people see it. And it's very similar to what D.E. Shaw is saying. It's like, you're just describing me as a hedge fund. We have so much more. We have so much more talent than that. We can do so much more. And not only do they do investments, they wind up starting, like, incubating their own companies. A couple of these spin out and they do IPOs. But the reason this is important is because that's the mindset that leads Jeff to start doing research on what kind of company could you build on top of this fast growing phenomenon called the internet. So let's go back to this. So in 1994, when the opportunity of the internet began to reveal itself to the few people watching closely, Shaw felt that his company was uniquely positioned to exploit it. And the person he anointed to spearhead the effort was Jeff Bezos. There's a lot more detail in the book on how the different companies that they're going to start around this time and how Shaw thought about it. It's very interesting. Obviously, read that part. Shaw, who used the internet and its predecessor, remember, he was a professor. And at the very beginning, the internet was called the ARPANET. So it says he had used that. He was passionate about the commercial and social implications of a single global computer network. At the time, though, it was illegal to use the internet for commercial applications. They actually had to get that law changed. And I think that law was changed somewhere in the 90s, maybe 94, 92, 96, somewhere in there. Shaw and Bezos would meet for a few hours each week to brainstorm ideas for this coming technological wave. And then Bezos would take those ideas and investigate their feasibility. Shaw and Bezos discussed one of these ideas. They called it the everything store. Remember, Bezos is in his 20s at this time. And he starts Amazon when he's 30. Intrigued by Shaw's conviction about the inevitable importance of the internet. So this is, we cannot overstate the importance of influence and ideas and how one influence or one idea can change the course of your life forever. Jeff dedicated his entire life to building a company on the internet. Shaw is the one that put that conviction in his brain. One set of numbers in a newsletter was startling. So this is some of the research that Jeff's doing at the time. So it says the web activity, this is what Bezos is realizing. It's like, what the hell? Things are not supposed to grow this fast. So it says web activity had gone up that year by a factor of 230,000%. Things just don't grow that fast, Bezos said. It's highly unusual, and that started me thinking, what kind of business plan might make sense in the context of that growth? Bezos concluded that a true everything store would be impractical, at least at the beginning. He made a list of 20 possible product categories, software, office supplies, apparel, music, going on and on. The category that eventually jumped out to him as the best option was books. They were pure commodities. A copy of a book in one store was identical to the same book carried in another. So buyers always knew what they were getting. There were two primary book distributors at the time, so a new retailer wouldn't have to approach each of the thousands of book publishers individually. And most important, there were 3 million books in print worldwide, far more than a Barnes & Nobles could stock. So really, the note I left myself on that sentence, he identified his edge. He's like, okay, well, there's 3 million books out there. I forgot the exact number. Let's say 15,000 maybe 20,000 titles could be at a typical bookstore, something like that. So I was like, okay, well, if I can overnight, when I start this, I can be the world's largest bookstore. And that's actually how they described Amazon at the very beginning. Wound up being sued by Barnes & Noble because of that terminology, but that's also in the book as well. If he couldn't build a true everything store right away, he could capture its essence, unlimited selection, in at least one important product category. With that huge diversity of products, you could build a store online that simply could not exist in any other way, Bezos said. So that's another way to think about his edge. So I'm skipping over a couple of parts here. This is where he's like, oh man, this seems interesting, but here's the problem. He's married at the time. He's a nice apartment in Manhattan. He's making a lot of money. He's working for a flat out genius. He's got a great opportunity. And, you know, if you're discussing this, it's like, okay, I'm gonna quit this, move across the country and sell books online. People are like, what the hell is wrong with you? And so this brings me to the single most important idea I have ever learned from Jeff Bezos. It's how to make decisions. And he calls it the regret minimization framework. I'm just going to read this whole section to you because it is so, so important. Bezos would later describe his thinking process. He came up with what he would call a regret minimization framework to decide the next step to take at the juncture of his career. When you're in the thick of things, you can get confused by small stuff, Bezos said. I knew when I was 80 that I would never, for example, think about why I walked away from my 1994 Wall Street bonus right in the middle of the year at the worst possible time. That kind of thing just isn't something you worry about when you're 80 years old. At the same time, I knew that I might sincerely regret not having participated in this thing called the internet that I thought was going to be a revolutionizing event. When I thought about it that way, it was incredibly easy to make the decision. And as you can imagine, everybody around him, including his mom, is like, what are you doing? And she's like, why don't you just work on this at night and weekends? And his response to her was fantastic. It's just one sentence. He says, no, things are changing fast. I need to move quickly. So he packs up his stuff, starts doing research and decides to move to Washington. Him and his wife at the time drive across country. And I just want to read this paragraph because it's just absolutely fantastic writing. A day later, they stopped at the Grand Canyon and watched the sunrise. He was 30. She was 24. And together, they were writing an entrepreneurial origin story that would be imprinted on the collective imagination of millions of internet users and hopeful startup founders. So one thing you learn when you study the life and career of Bezos is he's always be learning. He never thinks that he knows everything. And so even at this point, he winds up... pays for and drives and takes a 4-day course on book selling. Not only would you describe Bezos as relentless in his pursuit and domination of Amazon and in the world at large, I guess, but also his relentless approach to learning. One of his colleagues said, he went to school on everybody. Okay, so this was very interesting. At the very beginning, just a few sentences for you here, there was already people selling books on the internet, books.com, and they just realized, we just need to do better than they do. And the bar was really, really low. People hadn't figured out how to not only do you have to build everything in the early days of the internet, like the payment infrastructure, the logistics, all that other stuff, but you'd order a book from books.com and it'd come and it looked like somebody chewed on it. It was just, they hadn't figured out how to do it. So it says, as crazy as it might sound, it did appear that the first challenge was to do something better than these other guys. There was competition already. It wasn't as if Jeff was coming up with something completely new. And that's a lesson we've learned over and over again that, you know, if sometimes you don't want to create the market, right? You could just do a better job than other people out there and you could build a business around that. And then we see choosing of the name. It's an insight into Jeff's goal. The Amazon is not only the largest river in the world, it's many times larger than the next biggest river. It blows all other rivers away, Bezos said. More about the tenuous early days of Amazon. Amazon had a line of credit, but it would regularly max out its account, and Mackenzie would then have to walk down the street to the bank and write a check to reopen it. Everyone was working long days, scrambling to keep up, and not getting enough sleep. And I think Jeff said that raised the first $1 million or $2 million of Amazon, I forget it was. He had to go to like something like 30 or 50 different meetings. I don't have it in front of me, but it's a number like that. And he said the most common question when he was trying to raise funds was, what is the internet? And I want to quote one of the early investors because this is something that it's just another law of human nature, that passion is infectious. So this investor says, Jeff swept me off my feet. He was so convinced that what he was doing was basically the work of God and that somehow the money would materialize. The real wild card was, could he really run a business? That wasn't a gimme. Of course, about 2 years later, I was going, holy shit, did we back the right horse? And so now we get more insights into his personality and the word that's used over and over again, bold, 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 bold. It was used, I think, three or four times in an email at the very beginning written by Joy. So it's something that anybody at Amazon talks about all the time. And Jeff talks about bold, using the word bold a lot as well. Little by little, he was revealing his true self to his employees. He was unusually confident, more stubborn than they had originally thought, and he strangely and presumptuously assumed that they would all work tirelessly and perform constant heroics. He assumes that because that's his standard default mode, right? When his goals did slip out, they were improbably grandiose. So he's talking to an early employee who likes to kayak, and they barely know how to sell books at this time, and this is a conversation they're having. It's hilarious. Bezos began telling him that he envisioned a day when the site would not only sell books about kayaks, but kayaks themselves, subscriptions to kayak magazines, and reservations for kayaking trips, everything related to the sport. I thought he was a bit crazy. At the time, we had about 40 books in the warehouse. So there's two things happening in this next paragraph. One, we see that Jeff has this ethos that everything can be improved, everything's open to change, and two, that if you don't have that same mindset he does, he's going to run right through you. So this guy named Breyer's there. Breyer's tenure at Amazon was short and rocky. Bezos wanted to reinvent everything about marketing, suggesting, for example, that they conduct annual reviews of advertising agencies to make them constantly compete for Amazon's business. Breyer explained that the advertising industry didn't work that way. He lasted about a year. Over the first decade at Amazon, marketing VPs were the equivalent of the doomed drummers in the satirical band Spinal Tap. Bezos plowed through them at a rapid clip, looking for someone with the same low regard for the usual way of doing things that Bezos himself had. So Howard Schultz is the founder of Starbucks. There's a funny meeting about that Bezos had with Schultz. Starbucks is a lot more successful at the time than Amazon is. And so they're thinking about doing some kind of deal to give Amazon like a physical presence using Schultz's stores. And I just thought this part was hilarious. Schultz told the pair that Amazon had a big problem and Starbucks could solve it. You have no physical presence. That's going to hold you back. Bezos disagreed. He looked right at Schultz and told him, we're going to take this thing to the moon. So Amazon starts getting some traction. They're getting a lot of press. People are buying books online. And I thought this was really interesting what Jeff said. And this was after a meeting with Barnes & Noble's. Barnes & Noble the CEO met with Jeff saying, hey, you know, we're going to crush you. We're going to launch a website. And Jeff really picks up on the edge that smaller companies have. And that's the ability for a smaller company to focus just at a level that a big company can't match. So he says, Jeff was always a big believer that disruptive small companies could triumph. It wasn't the end of the world. We knew we had a challenge. And this is something that he also tells a group of Harvard Business School students. He goes and gives a presentation on Amazon. And afterwards, the class is like this exercise where they're saying, hey, what would you do if you were Jeff? And they tell him, like, you need to sell. Like, you're crazy. This is not going to work out. And so I'm going to skip over that. But I want to tell you Jeff's response to them. You know, the response to hearing a group of Harvard Business School students saying, hey, get out now, sell to Barnes & Noble. And he says, you may be right, but I think you might be underestimating the degree to which established brick and mortar businesses or any company that might be used to doing things a certain way will find it hard to be nimble or to focus attention on a new channel. Jeff is a student of history. He knows his business history. He derived the exact correct insight there. I guess we'll see is how he finished it. Let me read that part to you. I think you may be underestimating the degree to which established companies that might be used to doing things in a certain way will find it hard to be nimble or to focus attention on a new channel. That is why there will always be new companies. That is the opportunity right there. So we're in 1998. They're still selling only books. And this is a reminder that problems are just opportunities in work clothes. The famous quote from Henry Kaiser. I think it's founders number 66, somewhere back there. And then the influence of Richard Branson on Jeff Bezos. This guy brought some information to Bezos. He says he brought Bezos findings from a survey that showed a significant majority of customers did not use Amazon.com and were unlikely to start simply because they didn't buy very many books. I brought him very bad news about our business, and for some reason, he got excited. Bezos now felt expansion into new categories was urgent. In customers' mind, the Amazon brand meant books only. He wanted to be far more malleable, like Richard Branson's Virgin, which stood for everything from music to airlines to liquor. And we see, even from the very early days of Amazon, Jeff's just fundamental belief in what he was doing. He says this sentence somewhere between the year 1998 and the year 2000, "I think our company is undervalued. The world just doesn't understand what Amazon is going to be." So one thing, the one advantage that founder-led companies have is their ability just to move extremely fast. And we saw this, the podcast I just did, if you haven't listened to, on Johnny Ive, talks about the early days of when Jobs came back to Apple. They're building the iPod at the time. This guy, Rubenstein, is having a meeting where they realize, hey, there's these new slim hard drives. We can fit, you know, thousands of songs on here. We have this idea for an MP3 player. This could be a great idea. So he comes back from the meeting, goes to the hotel because they're in Tokyo at the time. I think they're Japan. I'm pretty sure they're in Japan. But and he's like, hey, I need $10 million. And we can start building this MP3 player that we want to. And Steve says yes immediately. And then he's like, I'm giving you $10 million right now, but this better be ready by Christmas. And so we see Jeff doing the exact same thing, moving extremely, extremely fast. Around that time, Wright showed Bezos the blueprints for a new warehouse. The founder's eyes lit up. This is beautiful, Bezos said. Wright asked who he needed to show the plans to and what kind of return on investment he would have to demonstrate. Don't worry about that, Bezos said. Just get it built. Don't I have to get approval to do this, Wright said. You just did, Bezos replied. This next section is all about what Jeff learned from the autobiography of Sam Walton. This is why, again, founders exist, because you see this example of somebody being inspired by reading the autobiography, the biography of somebody that came before them, taking those ideas and applying them with vigor to their own work. If you really think about it, you can pick up the paperback version of Sam Walton's autobiography. Bezos probably spent $10 on this book. And those ideas, it's not hyperbolic to say, those ideas made him billions. The application, the successful application of those ideas in a $10 book made him billions. Bezos stopped by with a copy of Sam Walton's autobiography, Sam Walton Made in America. Bezos had imbibed Walton's book thoroughly and wove the Walmart's founder's credo about frugality and bias for action into the cultural fabric of Amazon. He talks about those two ideas over and over and over again. Bezos does, that is. And he learned that from Sam. He had underlined one particular passage in which Walton described borrowing the best ideas of his competitors. So what Bezos did to Walton, Walton did to other people like JCPenney, Sol Price. Every other retailer you come across, Walton did the exact same thing. Bezos' point was that every company in retail stands, or every company period, stands on the shoulders of the giants that came before it. The book clearly resonated with Amazon's founder. On the last page, a section completed a few weeks before his death, Walton wrote, "Could a Walmart-type story still occur in this day and age? My answer is, of course it could happen again. Somewhere out there right now, there's someone, probably hundreds of thousands of someones, with good enough ideas to go all the way. It will be done again, over and over, providing that someone wants it badly enough to do what it takes to get there. It's all a matter of attitude and the capacity to constantly study and question the management of the business." That is the end of the quote from Sam, picking up this book again. Jeff Bezos embodied the quality Sam Walton wrote about. Thanks for making it to the end of this preview. If you're hearing this, that means you haven't yet upgraded to the Misfit feed, and you're only hearing partial episodes of Founders. If you'd like to access the full episodes, you can upgrade by tapping the link that's in your show notes on your podcast player, or you can go to founderspodcast.com. When you do that, you'll immediately unlock every full-length episode. These episodes are available nowhere else. Every episode is about the life story of a person who led such a remarkable life that somebody wrote a book about it. You'll learn from people like Walt Disney, John D. Rockefeller, Cornelius Vanderbilt, Steve Jobs, Benjamin Franklin, Frank Lloyd Wright, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, Andrew Carnegie, Leonardo da Vinci, the Wright brothers, Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett, Enzo Ferrari, Levi Strauss, Coco Chanel, Larry Ellison, Richard Branson, and many more. You'll learn from the founders of companies like Nike, Rolls-Royce, IBM, Home Depot, Atari, GM, Cadillac, Patagonia, Adidas, IKEA, Sony, and many, many, many more. Many people in history, some of the smartest, most productive people to ever live, took time out of their schedule to read biographies and learn from great people that came before them. By upgrading, you will be doing the exact same thing. Mark Andreessen said it best when he was telling an audience why he spent so much time reading biographies. He said, there are thousands of years of history in which lots and lots of very smart people worked very hard and ran all types of experiments on how to create new businesses and invent new technology. They ran these experiments throughout their entire lives. At some point, somebody put these lessons down in a book. For very little money and a few hours of time, you can learn from someone's accumulated experience. There is so much more to learn from the past than we often realize. You could productively spend your time reading experiences of great people who have came before you and learn every time. The more you know, the more you can do. Do not wait. Don't dilly-dally. Upgrade now by tapping the link that's in your show notes that's available on your podcast player or going to founderspodcast.com.